Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
Not all monsters are under the bed. Some are sleeping next to you. Welcome to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, featuring retired FBI special agent and chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, Robin Dreeke.
It is the second anniversary now of the murders of those 4 college students in Moscow, Idaho. Very hard to believe 2022 was when that took place, and we still have not yet had a trial. We still do not have a person that has been convicted, but we certainly have an accused, Brian Koberger. We've been talking about him now for, well, almost 2 years in this case. There's been several changes to where this will all be taking place in those 2 years, including a venue change. We've seen various motions by attorneys. We're going to take a look back on this case, where it's at right now and where it is going here at this 2-year anniversary mark, with Robin Dreeke, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Okay, 2 years in, venue changed. We're now having this in the Idaho or in the Boise, areas where that's going to be happening in Idaho, no longer in Moscow. Where do you think this sits 2 years in? What's your thoughts on the case as everything that we've known through all these motions all this time?
Yeah, as we said from the get-go, as soon as the defense attorney got involved with this, she's doing a great job of delay, 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 doubt, doubt, doubt. The fact that there's still no one else that's even popped up or been suggested as another potential person that could have committed this is very telling, I think. Again, I think she's doing a good job of mitigating everything she can possibly do to sow reasonable doubt, to mitigate things. I mean, even I still get hung up every time they say she has an alibi for him because he goes out for late night drives. And I've really thought about this in terms of what you and I always talk about is that life behavior arc. No, she didn't come up with an alibi. She came up with identifying a behavior arc of him going out for a nightly drive. Okay. Yeah. And if you went for a nightly drive past their house, then jumped out and killed someone, you know, that fits it fits his behavior arc. So I don't see how a behavior arc is an alibi if it could reasonably take you right by their house.
That's the part that doesn't work.
Yeah, it don't work.
Nightly drives. Okay. Well, what's the history? Okay. How can we be okay? Let's look at your cell history. Okay. Oh, it happens you're driving by this house as well on your nightly drives to go see the stars. That's not stalkerish at all, that you happen to be going by this same house over and over.
And on the night that you happen to be going by their house and it's the night of the murder, your cell phone automatically stops pinging one night out of night. In other words, we got a spike. Uh-huh. And when was the spike? The spike of a change was the night of the murders.
I mean, this is a guy with literally the worst luck ever, somehow got his DNA on a knife sheath while looking at it at a store. I guess there's some possible explanations, but I mean, the other thing, then somehow all of the evidence ties him back to the location. He has no solid alibi. I don't know. I mean, I feel like this is a case, unlike what we saw in Delphi, where there will be a lot of things that are going to come out from behind the curtain that we are unaware of yet on the part of the prosecution that are going to put him much more in that place, even more than they already have. We've heard nothing of the digital evidence. They did take his computers. They checked all that stuff because of the gag order. Luckily, nothing has leaked out yet in that department. Look, if there's nothing on those devices, I'll be shocked. And if there's nothing there, I'm going to question whether it's Koberger. But if there is something on those devices, you probably got your right guy.
Yeah, it's lining up. It's lining up well. To me, it's a slow process, way too slow for anyone's liking, unless you're Koberger, obviously. But I think at least it seems to be thorough. It seems to be exhaustive. Because that the data points are just there. I like the fact that there's behavior there that's got a lot of synchronicity. There's just a lot of things that are the only thing that I'm still, and I know the author Howard Bloom. Mm-hmm. When Night Comes Falling, I have my notes from reading it. Is very good read, very good book, and his postulate there is saying that. That only one of the girls was actually targeted by Koberger. The only thing that still remains a mystery to me behaviorally is why them, you know, why the girl, you know, cause I don't, cause again, maybe this will come out in the prosecution when we see everything, but I'm missing the actual link to the girls. His behavior definitely to me fits a pattern of someone who potentially could do this, but I'm not seeing the link yet.
I think the only thing I could say to that would be the impulsivity of males that kind of fit that incel profile. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if he's exactly that, but he's pretty damn close. There's a lot of impulsivity with those people. It doesn't take a lot to set them off from a female interacting with them in their life. I've witnessed it with people and I've been very put back and like, what the hell? And it's creepy and it's scary, but it doesn't take a lot. I mean, I'm with something like this, it could have been one weird interaction at a restaurant or something. She could have been a server. We don't know. But I'm guessing there was something where she somehow, he took it as being blown off, where it may have just been simple as, I'll come back for your order. And then he took that as, fuck those women. Those, you know, because I've seen that reaction with some men. And they hold that grudge. And they'll like, you, and I'm speaking hypothetically here, but what I've seen in some people, some men in my life, especially when I was younger, you see some men with these sort of attitudes, they'll never go back to that restaurant again because that woman did this to me. And it's just very harsh and very deep. So I don't
wound
know
collectors.
That, yeah, I don't know that they're exactly very much a wound collector and like seeking out wounds, like magnets for wounds. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that it took to this... any idea of a in-depth relationship or connection, I think it could have been as simple as that. I'll come back for your order. And then he had that grudge. She's attractive. It's someone who he views in his mind he could never get while never looking at himself as to why his personality is so off-putting. It's her fault. And if he's in some sort of weird, twisted idea of, you know, I want to go commit a crime and I want to see what it's like, who should I target? Well, who's wronged me? Who could be my enemy? And if that's it, I mean, that, so that rage can go somewhere.
And you just laid out exactly what I want to see.
Yeah.
You know, I would like to see that data point of something right in there, right in that little nook. Because again, it's all there to me. I mean, the DNA on the knife sheet, you know, the touch DNA, that to me is the sealer for me. And his behavior, all the other things he's done, yes. But I would still like one more little nugget that draws the connection between it. And it could be something as simple as that. And maybe when they did the forensic interview on the forensic analysis of his computers and his digital footprint and things like that, there might be a record of that, because if he has stalker traits, which it looks like he may have stalker kind of personality traits in there, they tend to record things down. So if he is a recorder of things, journaling, diarying, you know, whatever it is, you know, we might see that come out in prosecution. But But why it's taking so long? I just think defense is doing a really, they're doing their job.
They are. I mean, the further you put this out, the, I don't want to say the more the wound has healed, but I think that's the nature of wounds. They do heal a little bit more over time. So the harshness of the moment of this happening slowly lifts for most of the population, not necessarily the families, though, by any means. But it's not the families that are on that jury. It's the citizens. And for the citizens, yeah, the shock goes away. August 11th of 25 is what they're saying for the, yeah, the starting of the trial. Expected to last until November 7th of 2025. So literally a year from now is when it should be wrapping up. Originally set for July 31st of 25. It's still a year, 3 years roughly from the date of the crime. Do you think it'll go back further? Do you think this will have an effect on a jury in terms of the impact of you know, the shock of all this happening in their neck of the woods, relatively?
It's a great question. So as soon as you mentioned that time frame and the jury, because that's all the defense is doing right now. They're really doing everything they can to mitigate any jury issues they're going to have. Interestingly, and you talk about, you know, the shock and the pain of it, the distance makes heals wound to people that are not emotionally tied to the victims. The victims' families will never have that wound healed. But when you're sitting on a jury, distance heals, distance and time will heal wounds and the emotional nature of it. So they're going to be focusing more on facts, data, and details. They're the likelihood of them being more pragmatic and looking at data points is going to probably be higher than emotional sides. And because I think from what we're seeing, they're going to have a lot of pragmatic data points on this compared to maybe eliciting emotional response, especially since the house was torn down, so they can't walk the ground. There's a lot of things emotionally they won't be able to, I think, draw the jury in with. They're going to be really relying on the DNA evidence, the cell phone triangulation evidence, you know, the whatever images they have, the cars, interviews of family, collections from trash cans, all of these different things. They're going to be really focused on all these details, which does not bode well for, I think, Koberger.
No. I'm wondering who's going to make the witness list for a crime that, you know, no one really saw. You have the two girls downstairs who I'm sure will probably be called up and probably thrown through the ringer on the part of the defense in terms of what they're going to talk to them about or challenge them about. But what I do wonder about is his parents. I also wonder about the people that Howard Bloom talked to. Or Blum talked to. In creating that book, because from if his reporting is accurate, and I have no reason to believe it, it's not. He talked to a lot of people who talked to the parents, who knew the parents, Koberger's parents, pretty well. And what I got out of it was that the parents kind of felt like maybe it's their son. I know they've made statements saying they are standing by their son. They never said they think he's innocent. They never said they think he's guilty. So I'm not going to put words in their mouth. But, you know, when they're talking to the friends of the parents off the record from what they were telling them, sounds like they kind of feel like, yeah, maybe Brian could have been capable of doing something like this. And powerful that's going to be.
Yeah, and his sister was saying something to the effect as well, I think.
Yeah.
Because, again, what I thought was really good, I went back and I looked at my notes on that book, which was really good. He did something really original I never thought of before. Again, that's why he's a Pulitzer Prize winning, you know, investigative reporter. So, of course, he knows how to do these things.
Sure.
He said he followed up on what the Idaho Police Department did, and that was he looked at the DNA genealogy online, found everyone connected to the Koberger family, and talked to everyone in there.
Yeah.
That's going to do what? It's going to fill out the nooks and cranny of the life arc as observed from other people. That gives a very good, solid picture, I think, of an individual you may or may not be looking at. So I think that was those would be people I think would be great potential.
You don't want to be the person in anyone's world where when they hear this story, someone looks at you and says, yeah, I could see that person doing that. I mean, if there's any inkling of that, that's not a good thing. I don't know anyone in my world right now that I would, if I heard this story, I would go, I could see them doing that. Like that's a personal friend or something. That just, it would be shocking. But it seems there's a lot of people in the world of Koberger that are like,
You know, that, you know, I'm just thinking the nonverbals of this, you know, is I, whenever we're assessing, at least whenever I'm assessing individuals that we just don't know and we could be 50-50 on, yeah. Because we don't have data points on their actions or evidence of things they might have done, I always look at the people around them and how the people around them view them.
Yeah.
And again, when you look at Delphi and or even the Gilgo Beach murders, mm-hmm. you know, Rex Uhrman. Yeah. You look at all these individuals, Lori de Belvallo, you know, and you look at all the people that are surrounding them. When you have people that are in tears breaking down because they're like, there's no way, there's no, you know, that they're just emotional because there's no way that this loved one could do that. As opposed to in the Koberger case, you get like you just did. Huh. I wonder.
Yeah. Yes. If you're contemplating that the person you know is capable of stabbing four college students and has this real animosity towards women, and you're contemplating, could he have done that? There's some likelihood that person could have done that. Yeah.
So here's an interesting factoid. It's semi-related, but I'll relate it to the area of just crime in general. When I, because again, my career was doing espionage cases, recruiting spies and things like that, which is focused 100% on human behavior and assessing behavior. Every time I had an espionage investigation come up, the first thing I did was I looked at the individual and is this person happy or unhappy? Because happy people do not commit espionage. Happy people do not commit crimes. Not all unhappy people will. But that's my first clue. And then when I start interviewing the people around them, the very first question I always ask someone that has a connection to someone who may be a suspect, I say, do you like them? If I get data points where people like this individual, they like working with this individual, and I got people that are in tears because they don't want this, because they care so deeply about this person, I'm like, no, we're good. Mm-hmm. Because that is a very big clue and indication that the likelihood of a behavior arc going down a dark road, granted, people have secret place, people keep shame hidden and they can do these dark things, but darkness and those behaviors inside someone have leakage in other aspects of life. They're either disagreeable, they're resentful, they're wound collectors. All these negative behaviors have leakage in all these other aspects of life. It makes you pretty unlikable. So even on the side inside the bureau where you have Earl Pitts, Robert Hansen, and you know, and other people that have betrayed our country. Robert Hansen was on my squad in New York before I got there. No one liked him. He's an ass. Oh, well, not that all asses commit espionage, but of course, then he commits espionage and it fits because he was very unlikable. He's a wound collector, victim, yeah. You know, he saw himself as a victim, so he's getting a secret retribution.
Yeah.
And so that's why I'm not just looking at the individual. I'm looking at everyone around them in life because they are the very telltale signs of do we have healthy relationships with people or unhealthy? Because again, unhealthy doesn't mean they're bad people. It just means that let's look a little more.
Yeah.
Because happy people do not commit crimes. And generally happy people, positive people with positive aspect about themselves have healthier relationships.
Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
All right, true crime addicts, let's cut the crap. You're knee-deep in the gory details of your favorite podcast when suddenly a commercial hits like a bad meal. Seriously? You deserve better. Upgrade to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, where you can binge without those annoying ads. Plus, get extended interviews that go deeper into the darkness and early access to episodes so you can be the first to know. It's like trading up from fast food to fine dining, but with more blood. So, go ahead, search for True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts. Subscribe and feast on the good stuff.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.